Welcome to The Anxious Voyage. If you think that title sounds bleak or foreboding, one of two things must be true. You're very lucky, or you need to get out more. On this program, we share stories of life and living. We compare notes. We discover commonalities. We accept that life is a glorious, heartbreaking thing, and we embrace and celebrate all of it. Take the ride with us. We're glad you're here. Now, here's your host, Mark O'Brien.
Hello again. Welcome back. We are indeed very glad you're here. We're coming to you, as always, from World Headquarters in Middletown, Connecticut. And this weekend at Middletown's own Palmer Field, we will be holding the annual javelin catching tournament. So you're absolutely going to want to show up for that, and you might want to bring your first aid kits. Anyhow, I am so absolutely delighted to welcome my longtime friend, Amy Labossière, to the program today. Amy, thank you for your willingness to be here.
Thank you for having me here, Mark. This is fantastic.
So I did a little homework over the weekend, and I discovered that you and I have known each other since November of 2022. I just love that.
November of?
I'm sorry, 2002. Whew. Yeah.
Wow.
2002.
I was wondering when it was exactly. That is amazing.
I went to work at the ad agency where we met in 2000, and then you came in November of 2002.
I'm going to check my resume and make sure the dates are correct.
Okay.
On my end, because that's amazing.
Well, and if it's not correct, we'll just do a whole other show.
That's good.
Can get it right again.
Time really flies, Mark.
It does. Well, it's because we're having fun. I was thinking about this conversation. I was thinking about you. I was thinking about much of the work that you've done. And the more I thought about it, the phrase "still waters" became a metaphor for me. And I'm fairly certain you think of it the same way. So I wonder if you could share the story of Still Waters, the place, and how it came to occupy the place it did, not only in your life, but I think in your consciousness.
Wow. Well, Still Waters as a place is where my husband grew up. And I remember the first time he brought me there and we drove out. I didn't know what to expect. You know, I grew up on Long Island, so I was used to like residential everything, house, driveway. And while I had done a lot of hiking and been in the woods and that kind of thing, I really didn't know anything about country living, certainly not rural Connecticut. And when he drove me out there, his mom was living on the property at the time. All the kids had moved away. His father had moved away. And there were these cottages, four cottages that were run down. This beautiful 12-acre pond, an old house built in 1730, surrounded by woods. Beautiful, beautiful setting. And I remember walking around with him and he was touring me and I was like, this place has so much potential. And I was going to grad school at the time for conscious evolution. And I thought, wow, you know, and we talked about it, I was like, this would make a great retreat center. And Dow was used to that. You know, he grew up, his family used to run it as a summer resort. His parents were teachers. And so he was like, yeah, you know, let's do something with this. And now this was much later when he and I got together that we actually started putting these, you know, wheels in motion and everything. Mm-hmm. But we wound up starting with renovating one cottage. And I remember putting on hazmat suits and ripping the ceiling down. And, you know, I mean, it wound up, did you ever see the Tom Hanks movie, The Money Pit?
No, but I am familiar with it.
The floor is falling in. I mean, this place was a money pit. However, it was like, it's like it had a presence and an energy, and there was something that needed to be created there. And We didn't know how we were going to do it. Just like his parents had said when they first drove in there in 1968, we don't know how we're going to do it. And they both say the other one said it.
And but do we're going to make this say thing that happen. To each other?
Yeah, I think he probably said he had the idea and I probably said I had the idea, but it doesn't even matter where the idea came from. I think the idea came from the place, actually. We were just tuning our frequencies to what wanted to be created. And that's what we do as artists. We tune to that. The project took a life of its own. And eventually it became everything that we wanted to build together. And this comes from me as a person where if you had asked me at any point in my life, career choices, hospitality would not have shown up on the radar in any way. Mm. It just wouldn't have. But we wanted this. We wanted to make this place a place for people to come, to feel what we felt when we were there, to hold space for healing, to invite any groups we could. And we did. And even when the place wasn't ready, we did. When there was two cottages and there we had extension cords cobbled together, running to the main house and, you know, like all sorts of stuff. And people came and we had wounded warriors. We had recovery groups. We had Christian women's groups. We had all sorts of stuff. And it was amazing. You know, it was, it's somewhat, it also hurts. It hurts because of the way that it ended, but it needed to end because it was too much and it wasn't going to be the forever path for us.
Ooh, I just, I just connected some dots. You know, I'll say something about this a little later maybe, but you know, the idea that it hurt, even as you recognize that it had to come to an end. So would you share with us how and why it came to an end and what, sure. What you had to contend with as it was ending?
Well, when the fire happened, which was right before I started my most recent path of recovery, which is coming up on 10 years next month. So actually it was March 30th, 2014, the main house caught fire. We were getting ready for some groups. Mm. And the main house caught fire and because we were just finishing up breakfast and smelled smoke. What is that? The fireplace is on. What is that? The last thing you think is my house is on fire, right? So anyway, it turns out that we're like, oh, I wonder if we're going to have to cancel the groups. But the main house became condemned. We needed to rebuild. It took 5 years for us to rebuild. I mean, there was all sorts of serendipitous things that occurred to enable us to even rebuild. But when we did, we rebuilt with a mountain of debt. And it went so far that we had unexpected things like having to put a brand new septic in, which pushed our budget, which meant we couldn't hire anybody to help us reopen. So we had to reopen on our own. And when we did that, we were already predisposed to burning the candle at both ends. You know, I'm booking groups, doing all the marketing, doing all the bookkeeping, doing housekeeping, cleaning, I mean, menu planning, chef, shopping at Restaurant Depot and getting, you know, making Instagram worthy food because we had to do everything the best we could. I mean, every hat I could possibly wear. And there's something, and then the groups would come. But anyway, so that was all came to a screeching halt, but we rebuilt after 5 years and the debt was crushing. We had neighbors encroaching on our property. So we felt really squeezed in. You know, building docks on the pond. It was a private pond. So we were squeezed that way emotionally. It was a very difficult thing to deal with. And the pandemic happened and Dow's father passed and there were all, and he broke his, you know, he tore his rotator cuffs, like all these things kept happening. You know how like there's that saying, choose or be dragged. Mm-hmm. This was a choose or be dragged situation. because either way, that property was squeezing us. It was squeezing the life out of us. And it was like, either you make another choice or we will make this choice for you, whoever we is, right?
Yeah. You know, I can imagine, I think I can imagine how it must have felt. And it makes me recall that I've heard people say that in particular circumstances, it's not only okay to quit, but it's rational and sane to recognize that you have to, painful as it is, difficult as it is, you have to. I think I want to ask you either, did you recognize that, or how long did it take you to recognize that that was the objectively necessary option?
Yes, I did recognize it, and I recognized it early. However, since I'm one half of this equation, with my husband being the other half and him having such deep roots at this place, literally, you know, this, so my soul felt connected to the property, but his family roots were there, right? So I had to honor and respect that. So as much as when I looked at it with my business hat, when the fire happened, it was over. I mean, really, but the other part of this is that my brain tends to catastrophize and I don't always see things clearly. And I know that about myself. So it could be really difficult to say, well, am I actually giving this a fair shot? You know, they always say leap and the net will appear. You have to take risks to accomplish anything. And so there's all this noise in my head over what's the right choice. And, you know, with Dow, you know, he needed to weigh in more than I did on this, because this place was part of him and he had a big letting go to do. And I had to hold space for that.
Wow. Wow. Extending the notion of Still Waters, which was the name of the property, I should state overtly.
Yes.
I once read a book called The Zen Path Through Depression by a guy named Philip Martin. And one of the things that he suggested in the midst of depression, and I don't think he actually even called it a meditation, but he said, try to imagine yourself as a smooth stone in the bottom of a clear running stream. Cool and cool water. I always think of that when I think of still waters. And so it fascinates me to think about the things you did after that enormous decision and how still waters became metaphorical for you and even extended to your recovery and the book that you wrote about your recovery. And I'm just going to tell people, it's called Finding Still Waters, The Art of Conscious Recovery. And I am going to come back to that title. But was that sense of still waters growing as a metaphor apparent to you?
No,
I don't think it matters any less or is any less powerful. It might be even more powerful if you didn't recognize it.
Well, I used to like to think about, and I still do, the idea of no matter what's going on crazy on the surface, inside is where we can find the stillness.
Mm-hmm.
However, that time being in that place, there was so much pressure. I equate it to actually being in a rock tumbler before it pitches me out into the water. And then I can settle, that rock can settle to the bottom.
Mm.
Life was putting me through the rock tumbler. And I knew I was being polished, but I did not, you know, find that, I didn't know that the metaphor was necessarily working. We had planned to spend the rest of our lives at that place. In fact, we had often joked about how at some point we were going to flip it into a retirement community and have all our artist friends move in. So life, you know, life is what happens when we're busy making other plans. And if I really listen, I can hear God laughing. Oh, you think that's how it's going to go, huh? Okay.
This is a two-part question. I think the second part of it might be ridiculous. First, did you know you were being polished? And the second part, which is probably ridiculous, is did you have any idea why you were being polished? And I will tell you that I'm asking that question in part because you are here and you are so relaxed and you seem so well rested and content. And after having been through that ringer, I'm not sure I'd be any of those things.
Well, thank you for that. I actually am somewhat well rested because my dog did wake me up at 2 o'clock in the morning last night, but that's a whole other thing. I don't really know if I knew that I was being polished the way I think of it now, because when I'm in the midst of something, it's really difficult for me to zoom out and see the 10,000 foot view. When I'm in it, I'm feeling whatever's going on. And I was in survival mode in that place, survival mode, because there wasn't enough hours in the day. There were too many tasks. We were running the art business at the same time to try to fund this thing, moving money around, getting, you know, trying to get grants, trying to get clients, figuring out, I mean, doing menu planning, so many jobs. I mean, I look back at how the hell did I do that? And then during that time, writing and publishing a book, like what? Because I published the book in 2018 and I was caring for Dow's elderly father before that. I mean, it was just piling on. So it was just very, very interesting.
Yeah. I've never thought about this before, but is it possible to long for boredom?
Huh. Yes, I think I've done it, but I don't think I'd ever actually want it because I don't think I would even know how to be bored. Yeah. My mother used to tell me when I was growing up, "Mom, I'm bored." And she'd say, "Go read the dictionary." She'd tell me to go read the dictionary if I was bored. But yet I still use the same 7 words over and over again to describe things. But
except for fabulous.
Fabulous, awesome, wonderful, amazing, you know.
I think it's easier to think about boredom when it's a choice. And you clearly didn't have a choice.
Mm-mm. Nope. I mean, if I'm going to be so far as to like compare myself with other people, I don't have children. So, you know, people that have kids and full-time jobs and side hustles, we call them now, you know, all these things, they have complicated, chaotic lives and they're in the rock tumbler and, you know, they have family stuff and pressures. This was just my version of that at that time. I don't know that it was any more insane than insane times for anyone. It was just my version of being squeezed, you know? I think we all get it.
Do we have to recognize, and I think we do, and this is part of the story I might come back to, but do we have to recognize that some people spend as much time or more than we do in the tumbler and never get smoothed or prepared?
Yeah.
That's a tough one. So I'll just share this quickly. I mentioned actually before we went on the air that I have a friend whom I've known since 1959 who's now in a nursing home, and I don't know if you've ever read the Herman Melville story Bartleby the Scrivener. I've seen Bartleby, the story of Bartleby, described as existential refusal unto death. And so to put it very simply, Bartleby simply made no choices. And his response to everything was, I would prefer not to. And I'm getting the sense, and this has been a really fast evolution because I've only known this guy's been in the nursing home for a month. But I'm transitioning from hope to thinking about my own notions of control to the reality that I may very well have to let go. And I was thinking, you know, this guy had the same chance as I think I did, or maybe I had the same chance as he did. I don't know if it's a different kind of insight or a different kind of ambition. I don't know, but anyway, I applaud you for the way you managed all of that and came out on the other side of it. And to whatever extent you could, extracted yourself out of all of that immediacy and survival mode to recognize that really, really tough decisions were called for. You know, I suspect there's many people who couldn't pull that trigger, regardless of the signals.
And ultimately, if we hadn't, it would have been pulled for us. I truly believe that. I think we would have been dragged away one way or another. And I think what really helps in all of this is a spiritual mindset and living a life with spiritual friends and other things and a path of recovery, because the first thing that we do in recovery is acceptance. And really trying to look at life on life's terms. And none of us control what happens to us. All we can control is how we respond to it. And that is where the power is.
Our mutual friend, Mark Fishman, says that the key to life is learning to live with uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that, to my way of thinking, that's a very profound flavor of acceptance.
Yes.
It's just whatever it is, it's going to be. And, you know, I still find myself thinking a lot about control when letting go is actually a more constructive response. You know, obviously there are, I don't know what, mundane things or something that we can actually control, but so much of what we might presume to control is beyond us.
Right. And sometimes letting go is still an attempt at control.
Ouch. Wow. Doesn't that take us back to the notion of quitting? And okay, woo. So then you got to lob judgment into that equation. Well, it seems like the same sane thing to do to give up here, but maybe that makes me a bad person. Maybe quitting on this makes me a bad person. Or you could do the whole thing about like, well, what if I just stay in it for a little while longer?
Right. Or if I was smarter, I could figure this out, right? Oh, all no. That negative self-talk and I think about this idea of control and letting go and the uncertainty with business. We're always trying to control and predict. So how do you take this spiritual notion of letting go, of embracing uncertainty, you know, saying to life, bring it on. it's tricky, and yet still be able to do those things when you don't have, you know, a huge financial backing or whatever, to make that work.
Yeah. And I will just suggest, we're going to take our first break here, but I will suggest that having that huge financial backing in some circumstances could actually be a disadvantage. And I think the answer to how do you do that, I think the answers are in art and consciousness which recalls the title of your book. And when we come back from the break, that's where we'll start. See you in 3 minutes.
Everybody has a story. Everyone's story deserves to be told. And the only bad stories are the ones we don't share. That's why Mark O'Brien created The Anxious Voyage. It's Mark's conviction that every story deserves to be shared, and his purpose is to give people in all walks of life, from any circumstances, a chance to tell their stories. The Anxious Voyage is now on syndicated Dream Vision 7 radio network every Monday at 1 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern Time, with live broadcast every first and third Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please tune in, please join Mark, and please share your stories.
Ever wonder what it's like to have your own radio show? Well, wonder no longer, because you can dip into the radio airwaves by being host for the day on syndicated Dream Vision 7 radio network. It's a fabulous way to get your radio feet wet. It's an opportunity to market your business, modality, or book. Have a guest, mention a sponsor, and take callers. Or you may want to facilitate a lesson by going solo. It's up to you. Listeners can be online, mobile, in cars with Bluetooth, or listen through Amazon's Echo by asking, "Alexa, play Dream Vision 7 Radio Network." For more details, go to dreamvision7radio.com and click on Host for the Day.
You can't establish your brand's authority without a voice. That's why, since 2004, O'Brien Communications Group, OCG, has been helping companies establish their authority, find their brand's distinct voices, and position their brands effectively and persuasively. So effectively that 9 of OCG's clients have been acquired by other companies. OCG's business model emphasizes efficiency and results, not hourly billing, markups, and media commissions. That ensures OCG's advice is unbiased and its clients aren't at financial risk. If you're ready to find your voice and use it to tell your story, OCG is ready to help. You can find O'Brien Communications Group on the web at obriencg.com. That's obriencg.com, or call 860-944-9022.
Calling all authors. Have you been considering an audiobook? Well, look no further. Come take advantage of Dream Vision 7 Radio Network's unique in-house audiobook production, which includes benefits and bonuses from our radio station. Let our knowledgeable staff guide you to create the audiobook you've always dreamed of without breaking the bank. Check out our full one-stop service from A to Z, including the process. Schedule a free consultation by calling 508-226-1723. That's 508-226-1723. Or go to dreamvision7radio.com.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.
Welcome back, everyone. And Amy, welcome back to you too. When I think about the subtitle of your book, and I'm going to remind everyone that the title of your book is Finding Still Waters, The Art of Conscious Recovery. It seems to me that every word in that subtitle is deliberate. Among other things, and we'll come back to this, I hope, among other things, you're an artist. Among other things, you have a master's degree in conscious evolution, which still makes my brain sweat, by the way. So I'm going to guess that the fact that you are an artist and the fact that you had studied conscious evolution, and again, maybe it wasn't deliberate or conscious. Sorry, I had to say that again. But when you contemplated recovery or the necessity of recovery, did you recognize that those two elements, art and consciousness, were necessarily going to play a part in your recovery?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it was art that brought me to my recovery. as well as consciousness, because I was also in that master's program when I first got sober. And one of the ways that this happened was I had made this sculpture. I don't know if you've ever seen this one, Mark, but it's about 5 feet tall. It's clear cylinder. It's actually in the book. It's clear cylinder filled with wine corks. And at the top of the piece are these mannequin arms and this red hair. And it's called Self-Portrait. I can stop anytime I want.
Oh.
And I was in a gallery show in Art Space, and this woman comes up to me. This woman comes up to me, and I'm standing next to the art piece, drinking wine, of course. And she comes up to me, and she leans in, and she says, "Do you think you have a problem with alcohol?" And I'm like, "What? No, what? No, this is whimsy. This is whimsy. That's all it is. I don't have a problem." And she said, "Well, you know," and she confided in, "you know, if you ever need help, let me know. I have resources for you." And I kind of fluffed it off. But she planted a seed with me that later came to fruition. But that was sort of the start, this art piece screaming at me, saying, "Hey," and literally it's called Self-Portrait. And there's a character, this figure, drowning in wine corks, which was really what was happening at the time. So the my recovery, I can't avoid being linked to my art and to the consciousness, because it's part of everything. It's just who I am.
How long after that woman whispered at you, did you take the necessity of your recovery seriously?
Well, at first 6 months, because that was the first time I came into recovery in 2009. And I stayed sober past my sober wedding. And then in 2012, I relapsed, which I didn't think was ever going to happen. I was like, I'm never going to drink again. I was determined. I said, I made my mind up. But I wasn't doing the things that I knew I should be doing to stay sober, because I thought mentally that I was just convinced. And so my relapse occurred and continued. It was until 2014. So
was there guilt, excuse me, was there guilt involved in your relapse? Did you feel guilty about that, or was it it wasn't, and I suppose I understand why you couldn't, but it wasn't something that you could just say was okay. Well, this is a matter of the uncertainty that I need to live with. So I expected I would remain sober. I didn't. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Because so much of my alcoholism is steeped in denial. There's like this, oh, it's not that bad. You didn't lose everything. Oh, maybe you're not really an alcoholic. How do you really know? You still have a car. You still have a place to live. You still have your primary relationship. You still have work. What, you know, I always thought an alcoholic was somebody in a trench coat under a bridge without a job. No offense to the people that do that, but I didn't understand what it was until I did. But when I relapsed, it was a big case of the efforts. I didn't care. You know, I was like, whatever. I don't care. I don't want to feel like this anymore, is what I said to myself.
Okay. So your decision to drink again was very deliberate?
Yeah, it was. I had gone to get an x-ray because I broke my toe. And I turned to my husband as we were going over Avon Mountain after the x-ray and said, "Hey, you want to get a bottle of wine and watch a movie?" He's like, "Sure." Get a bottle of wine. And that started it. But what ended it, what caused me to come back, was after the Stillwater's fire, I was drinking my face off for that next month. I mean, I just was trying to numb out, you know, bottle after bottle of wine. I just couldn't get enough. And I could feel the effects on my body. I mean, I am so lucky I didn't get worse consequences than just a terrible emotional state, you know? But so that was March 30th was the fire. And by May 5th, that was it. And I reached out to a friend and that started me back on my path, which, you know, I've been on now for coming up on a decade.
I remember seeing an interview some years ago with Ed Bradley interviewed Eric Clapton after Eric Clapton got sober. And he said, Eric Clapton said, he was drinking like 2 and 3 bottles of vodka a day. So what goes through my mind is if you're consuming 2 or 3 bottles of vodka a day, you got to be drinking all day.
Oh, yeah.
Did you get to that point?
Not particularly, unless I could rationalize that it was, you know, weekend brunch, start early. I was never a morning drinker, which I hear about, you know, people that are, you know, chugging vodka at 6 a.m. But I would occasionally lunchtime drinks, that kind of stuff. I did that when I was employed at one point at the agency we worked at together. I went home on my lunch break and poured myself a Grey Goose martini and had that for lunch and then went back to work and felt like, oh, dynamite. And then, of course, when I saw Mad Men, I'm like, oh, this is just what people do. This is okay. But no, I never got to that level with my drinking. But it was a daily occurrence of at least a bottle of wine and not include, you know, what I would drink with my husband and more. And it was just too much. And the reason how I really knew was that I was obsessed about it. So it was the obsession of my mind. Where's the wine? How much is there? When am I getting more of it? Where is it going to be? It's not that I was falling down drunk every day of my life. That's not what it was. The alcohol, the thought of it was occupying too much space in my brain. I needed to do other things with my mind and my life than think about wine. So that was important.
I'm connected with a guy through other circles entirely who's been in recovery for about 15 years. And he says to the alcoholic, the supply is the thing.
Yep.
That it's a constant preoccupation.
Yes. Yes. And it doesn't have to be, you know, handles of the dirtiest vodka you can think of. It can be, you know, I'm going to go with my shopping cart and shop for wine like I'm planning a party that's never going to happen. You know, and it's that obsession is debilitating because, I mean, once it's in the house and it's there, it's okay. You know, I knew it was there. It was like, okay, now I can go about and do whatever. And then at maybe 4 o'clock or maybe 3 o'clock or 5 o'clock, whatever, woo, crack it open, you know, and it just, because for women, they say that alcoholism progresses faster in women than men. It increases the risk of breast cancer by 50%. It's wow. Certainly not good for the liver or the body. You know, when they would say, the doctor would ask me, you know, oh, how many drinks do you have? And I'd a day, and I'd be like 1 or 2. And the doctor meant glasses. I meant bottles. And I never really cleared that up for them, you know, and it's just too much on the body and the mind.
So I don't know anything about this, but wouldn't that kind of alcohol consumption show up in like blood tests or urine tests or something?
I don't know. My blood work was pretty good. I mean, I've always had pretty good blood work, so I didn't really get those kinds of consequences. So outside of probably weight gain or whatever, but maybe I took care of it young enough. I'm sure it would have caught up with me if I kept going. My sister was type 2 diabetic later in her life when she got older. So I don't think she had the same problem as me, but I really don't know. I'm sure that eventually it would have caught up with me physically.
When you say you're not sure if your sister had the same problem as you, you mean drinking?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow. I find the psychology of the whole thing just so completely fascinating. Albert Camus was reputed to have kept a loaded revolver in the drawer of his nightstand because it represented for him the choice to not use it every
day. Wow.
And I mean, does anything that wacky ever go through your head? I mean,
no.
Oh, I'm going to keep that around because it represents the choice, my choice not to drink it.
No, I wouldn't want it around. Not that I think I'm going to pick it up, but because it's poison to me. And why would I want poison in my house? So I have no interest in it. It doesn't serve me. And I just don't want to tempt myself in any way. If I decide, whatever, I think I'll blow up my life today. You know, it's an easy choice. It's an easy choice.
We have a friend who's been in recovery. I can't even imagine how long, but he is really, really candid about it. And he said, you know, at one point I was still gainfully employed, but I was living in my car. And if I have a drink, that's where I'm going. I'm going right back there and I know it. That's just, oh my God, that's just astounding.
It's really scary. It really is.
I would like to take the second commercial break now because I want to make sure that we have enough time in the third segment to talk about your artwork.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'll just ramble on about all kinds of junk forever.
I love it.
So please come back after the break and we'll see everyone else in 3 minutes.
Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of evolutionary voices for the quantum age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience evolutionary voices for the quantum age Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com. You can't establish your brand's authority without a voice. That's why, since 2004, O'Brien Communications Group, OCG, has been helping companies establish their authority, find their brand's distinct voices, and position their brands effectively and persuasively. So effectively that 9 of OCG's clients have been acquired by other companies. OCG's business model emphasizes efficiency and results, not hourly billing, markups, and media commissions. That ensures OCG's advice is unbiased and its clients aren't at financial risk. If you're ready to find your voice and use it to tell your story, OCG is ready to help. You can find O'Brien Communications Group on the web at O'BrienCG.com. That's O-B-R-I-E-N-C-G.com or call 860-944-9022.
Calling all authors. Have you been considering an audiobook? Well, look no further. Come take advantage of DreamVision 7 Radio Network's unique in-house audiobook production, which includes benefits and bonuses from our radio station. Let our knowledgeable staff guide you to create the audiobook you've always dreamed of without breaking the bank. Check out our full one-stop service from A to Z, including the ACX process. Schedule a free consultation by calling 508-226-1723. That's 508-226-1723. Or go to DreamVision7Radio.com.
Everybody has a story. Everyone's story deserves to be told. And the only bad stories are the ones we don't share. That's why Mark O'Brien created The Anxious Voyage. It's Mark's conviction that every story deserves to be shared, and his purpose is to give people in all walks of life, from any circumstances, a chance to tell their stories. The Anxious Voyage is now on syndicated Dream Vision 7 radio network every Monday at 1 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern Time, with live broadcast every first and third Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please tune in, please join Mark, and please share your stories.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back, Amy. I just want to say to whomever might be with us today, when Amy and I worked together at an ad agency here in Connecticut, we did not share an office, because if we had shared an office, we would have done this all day, every day. We would have had a blast. We would have gotten no work for the agency done whatsoever and have been completely happy about it. So, Amy, I know you've been, or maybe still are, an actor, a voiceover talent, a writer, a marketing person. I will argue, given what I do for a living, that marketing is as creative as anything else. And then you found your way into visual arts, which I'll call them. How does that work? What was that evolution like? I would imagine you continue to find discovery in that work. Tell us about that, and tell us what it feels like, if you can.
Wow. For me, visual art has always been healing. And I first started it in 2003. So I already knew you by then when I started. Mm-hmm. And I was getting divorced. I was in the process of getting divorced, and I created my first artwork. And here's how it happened. I was online looking for, because believe it or not, you could search for things online in 2000, wow. Back in 2000, whatever that was, I just said.
I thought 2003. We were still using smoke signals back then.
Yeah, right. But I was looking for actor auditions, and I stumbled upon a website for something called Oil Drum Art. And I was like, oil drum art, what is that? And I looked at it, and it was this organization, a nonprofit run by Jack Lardis, who, interestingly enough, was in the ad agency business. I had no idea at the time. I hadn't met him yet, but I did. And he's a great guy and an amazing artist himself. And but I got an instant visual when I was on this website of an art piece I wanted to create. And I thought, where is this coming from? And I decided I would follow through on it. And that's the process for me. I get a visual and I follow through. So I see artwork. I see it in my head all the time. I can't always create what I see, because I am limited by whatever my technical abilities are. I mean, I might see a gorgeous painting in my mind's eye. I'm not an oil painter, or I wouldn't even consider myself an acrylic painter. I will play with paint, but I don't consider myself a painter. So I do have limitations on what I can create, but it's all about healing either something within myself or something that I feel in the world. That first piece that I created was called Crude Reality, and it was collage on a half of an oil drum. And Jack even cut the oil drum, had the oil drum cut for me a specific way. And actually it was through that art that I met my husband Dow. So it's kind of interesting that art brought us together, because I was showing that piece, you know, a couple of years later, and that's where I met him. So
I was having an exchange with a woman on LinkedIn last week. And actually, I think it was in response to another one of these shows. And she said to me, in response to one of my comments, oh, she was talking about healing. She said to me, in response to one of my comments, love is healing. which I thought was just beautifully powerful. So I'm thinking that, and then you tell me that's where you met Tao, through artwork. Wow. So are you, when you perceive, and I'm going to leave that one open, that's why I say perceive. When you perceive your technical limitations, does that daunt you? Does it keep you from trying?
No, it doesn't keep me from trying. It used to really bother me because I would, the times it bothers me is when I'm in comparison. If I'm comparing my skill set to someone else's and saying, this isn't good enough, I'm not good enough, which is bull. It's a limiting story that doesn't serve me. Yeah. And I can also, you know, there's times when I've asked Dow, hey, can you help me figure something out? What should I, you know, I don't do that a lot because I kind of get possessive with my artwork, but here and there he'll do things for me. Like he'll build me a really cool wood frame for one of my pieces. Or he'll give me some technical advice. And sometimes I push it away or sometimes I will embrace it. But I think that getting that noise out of the way is a really important creative process, because if I never practice the art that I'm drawn to, I will never get good. Same with my writing. You know, my writing, when I wrote my book, I went fast. I published early. I was pushed by my own self. You got to do this. You got to get this thing done. You got to put it out there. But don't tell anybody if you don't have to. Just quietly put that out there. And maybe somebody will, you know, there's somebody that needs to read it will read it, because it's very shy about it, right? But I have to just, if I waited, I would never create anything. If I waited until if I thought I was good enough or to the par that I wanted it to be, I would never create anything or put anything out there. And that's not fair to hold my own creativity hostage from the world. I need to let it out. Wow. And I'm saying that not only because I want other people that might be holding back their own creativity to hear it, but also because I need to hear it.
Yeah. Whoa, that's interesting. I actually find that to be something of a pattern on this show. You know, my hope was that people who listened to the stories of guests on this program would think, whoa, you know, maybe I can do that too. Then I discovered that my guests find ways to hold themselves responsible for doing things. And now I'm going to admit, and I'm pointing at those guitars back there, I'm in exactly the same trap, because I think, well, if I can't pick that thing up and be George Benson, then what is the point? and it's completely about comparison and judgment. And you're absolutely right. It's self-defeating. And I also remember having heard an interview with, I don't know if you know who the guitarist Frank Marino is, Frank Marino and Mahogany Rush. Anyway, if you don't know who he is, you should look him up. But I was listening to an interview and he said, there's an enormous difference between saying, I want to do something and I'm going to do something. And I hear you saying that when you see something, when you envision something, when you feel compelled or called to do something, you're going to do it.
Yes. Yes.
Is that just an inclination, or do you or can you recognize that as being courageous? It is courageous. Do you think of it that way?
I think it's courageous when I share it with people, going beyond just creating, you know, there's so much vulnerability. However, when I really think about the fact that we are all on this giant rock spinning throughout outer space in the middle of nowhere, why am I holding myself back?
Oh boy.
It serves no one for me to do that. You know, I have a regular weekly meditation practice. I go to a group meditation called Artist Morning, and they do this visual. It's led by this guy, Darius, out of Canada, and it is a guided meditation and then journaling, 20 minutes of journaling. quite often during that journaling time is when I start sketching different artworks and things, like my piece that's in the Monastery Gallery of Art right now, that's based on the 12 steps. It's totally done in fabric. That piece, the ideas of it came to me during that meditation. And so if I deny that, and if I never created that, the ripple effects of the art would never happen. I went to the opening and people wanted to talk to me about the work. People came up to me and asked me about it. And they asked me to say a little something at the opening and that kind of stuff. And there's all sorts of gorgeous art there. And they're looking at my stuff and being impacted by it. I don't know what's going to happen when they leave, how that has changed them a little bit or moved them along on their path, you know? So we can't hold it back. We need to share it. We really do.
There's a TED talk I witnessed once, and I can ask the person who shared it to find it again. But this woman who gave the TED talk was talking about our responsibility to use our gifts and to put them out in the world exactly as you're describing. And maybe this is tied to guilt, I don't know. But I actually feel more comfortable about doing things like that, especially with my writing, if I view it as a responsibility. If mm-hmm. I create this, I have a responsibility to share it. I don't know what it means. I don't know what it's going to do. As you're suggesting, I don't have the vaguest idea if it will ripple at all. But if I create it, I have a responsibility to share it.
Right. And it can be tricky because, you know, there's that good old ego that likes to whisper, yeah, who do you think you are doing this, right? That kind of stuff. But I would say about, if I may, about you and your writing is amazing. And so to me, it looks effortless when you share it because you are sharing something that is so well crafted that how could you not? I feel the same way about my husband's work. His skill set is so refined. You know, the mural that I can see from outside my window of the giant turtle, it's amazing. It uplifts thousands of people. There are 45,000 people in Hartford over the weekend for the UConn basketball thing, somewhere around there. Thousands of people saw that and were uplifted, you know, because the skills are there. If you don't have the skills and you share it anyway, what does that say? It's interesting.
It is interesting. Yeah, I'm just going to share this with you, and then I want to make sure that people can know where to find you, et cetera. I read a piece over the weekend, and it was Eric Clapton again. He was talking about the first time that he saw Stevie Ray Vaughan play. He said it was as pure a manifestation of channeling as I'd ever witnessed, and he said he actually had to leave. He had to leave and go collect himself because otherwise he would have completely lost his confidence. So I want to tell you that I'm profoundly grateful for what you said about my writing. It feels to me like channeling because I can go back and read things I've written in the past and not have the slightest recollection of having written them. So yep. Please do tell our viewers and listeners where they can find you. I know LinkedIn is one place, but I also know you have a website.
Yes, my website is amylabossiere.com. If you don't know how to spell it, just try. It'll show up anyway. Or find me on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook and Instagram as well. Yeah.
Okay, Amy, it's going to sound feeble when I tell you that I'm so grateful that you came on with me today. We could have easily done this for 2 hours. So how about if we just agree that we'll do it again?
That sounds wonderful, Mark. I really appreciate being on here. I mean, this is like sitting in your office in 2002, just talking about life. And it's amazing. It's amazing to be here and to be on this fabulous show you created. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And it's a conversation like this one that makes me love and believe in connection. Thank you. And I thank everyone else for joining me. There's two more Mondays left in this month. I won't be on either one of those, but I'll be on the first Monday in May, and I'll see you then. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for tuning into The Anxious Voyage, the program dedicated to sharing stories, helping people, and celebrating life. You can see and listen to The Anxious Voyage on syndicated Dream Vision 7 radio network every Monday at 1 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern Time, with live broadcast every first and third Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. If you have a story to tell, or if you know someone who does, please email the host, Mark O'Brien, at mark@obriencg.com. In the meantime, please remember, the only bad stories are the ones we don't share.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.